still carrying the child over one shoulder. He strode further into the compartment. Behind them, the ramp began to rise towards the shut position. Karras looked out on a sight he had only ever seen from the nearby mountainsides. There below him was the forest, vast and ancient, the home of the tribe, provider of all they had ever needed, all he had ever known. The ship swung south, the ground wheeled below him, and Karras saw great clouds of black smoke and the glow of vast fires raging out of control in the place where his people had lived since the tribe's first tale began. The ramp was half closed now. It was the last he ever saw of his birth world. In the seconds before it closed completely, in the last slice of sky visible, Karras saw movement to the southwest. Three slender, elegant ships shaped like arrowheads. They streaked off into the distance. The ramp slid home, locking bolts rammed into place. The white-faced giant placed him gently down on a seat far too large, and without either of them speaking a single word, they began to talk. It was the first time anyone had addressed Karras mind to mind. In that moment, he learned of the Imperium and of the Emperor on Terra. On that day, he discovered purpose. Vivid as it had been, the reliving of that day, the details, the sensations, it dissipated like smoke from a bolter barrel now. Karras found himself back in the unknowable void, just a disembodied spark of identity and experience. This is not death. It cannot be. I remember Chiaro. I remember all of it. Voss and the others, they dug me out. A feeling of great dread swept over him. Memory muttered a fell name, and his emotions surged. He shrunk back from it, but it insisted on his memory, and soon he was remembering in detail, whether he wanted to or not, the encounter with the demon on the ethereal waters of the Black River. Epaximan, Prince of Sorrows. The entity's presence had sullied the river, made the raging waters stink with foul decay. It had broken through the boundaries of its own realm to issue Karras a dark ultimatum. Pass a message to the exorcist Darian Routh, or face dire consequences. Karras had almost died that day, his armor shattered, his body speared and pulverized by rocks both sharp and heavy. But he had not. The Saint Navarre had returned for him. Epaximan claimed agency in bringing it back. But the lips of all demons are black with lies, thought Karras. A psychic construct placed at that point on the primary timeline by Athiocordatus had bought Karras his escape, pulling him out of the Black River and the demon's torment. You knew my cardit, and yet, could you not have prepared me? There was shame and a certain bitterness at the thought. Had Athiocordatus known ahead of time, he would surely have prepared his protege. The Death Spectre's Librarius must have divined the demon's intrusion only after Karras had left Occludus, his chapter's crypt world home. Had they seen this too? This what? Where was he? Why was he here, trapped in this bodiless state? Answers would not come. The absence of any sense of time and space threatened to madden him. Nothing to grasp, nothing to ground him. All he had here were memories of the past, and those that came to him were not of his choosing. He was being forced to relive things he did not invoke. He saw again the three deaths he had endured as rites of passage. He remembered the slaughter he and his brothers had unleashed on a dozen alien-held worlds in the Ghoul Stars, saw good friends die, and others raised to great glory by their deeds. He recalled ceremonies celebrating great victories, and remembered others less joyous, honoring the heroic sacrifice of brothers lost in desperate battle. And then, after all this, there came again his flight through the winter woods of his birth world. Only this time, it did not play out quite the same. The memory started as before, the screams from behind him, the sounds of gunfire, the roar of hungry flames, and the stabbing winter air in his young lungs. This time, however, at the moment his body angled right towards the eastern edge of the trees, everything around him abruptly froze. It was as if he were in a sensorium feed, suddenly paused. He ran on for a few steps, but the stark absence of noise and blazing heat struck him so hard that he stopped, turned and looked back. The only sound now was his ragged breathing. It slowed as he stood there in total confusion. The trees glowed with fire, but the flames didn't move. Nothing did. They had no hunger, no heat, nothing but shape. And then a voice, soft and strangely accented. Feminine.
"We knew they were coming for you."
Karis spun, turning towards the source of the sound. There was no one there.
"It was we who stalled them while your warrior brethren got you out. Ignorant as ever, you Monkey did not even detect us."
The voice sounded so close now that Karas felt hairs prickle on the back of his neck and arms.
"I gave the orders myself," it continued. "We could not allow you to fall into the hands of the great enemy. What terrors you would have wrought had your fate been to ravage the stars as one of the foul. Such an abomination you would have become."
Karis spun again, angry now, scowling fiercely. Finally, he found himself facing the source. There before him stood another child, apparently of an age close to his own. She was a pale, slender thing with long blonde hair, fine-boned and elegant, dressed in richly jeweled robes of shimmering white silk.
"This is no memory," he thought. "This is an intrusion."
The girl regarded him without smiling, her face unreadable. Karis spoke, and found to his surprise that it was his adult voice, his space marine voice, that issued forth from his child lips.
"Who are you?" he demanded.
"Arangi," answered the girl. "It is a contraction, but it will suffice."
Taking her eyes from him, she crossed to a tree and stared at the detail of the bark, stroking it with one delicate hand.
"Your memories are richly detailed. You had a fine mind, even before the implants and the training. I was not mistaken about your potential, nor about the threat you represented."
She glanced over at him.
"May still represent."
She turned back to the tree.
"We shall soon know if I am to regret my part in your journey."
"And what journey is that?"
Karis growled. A flicker of a smile crossed her small, perfect mouth. She looked him up and down.
"I see a 9-year-old boy running for his life while his people die behind him, die because of him. Let no guilt assail you, however. Their lives meant little. In truth, you were something of a bargain, as you Monkey might say."
She continued to study the bark of the tree, apparently fascinated by the folds and tiny cracks and bumps, by how some parts were smooth and others were rough. Karis was about to explode at her, to deny her words, but he could not. She had not spoken falsely. Part of him had always known. His people had been killed, all of them. And he was the reason. The murderous red giants had come solely for him.
How did...
She cut him off mid-question.
Countless tribes on countless worlds are watched. You know this. The most promising have always been marked and tested. The darkest, foulest foes of your bloated, cancer-riddled Imperium are ever in a race to deny your ranks and swell their own.
You talk of the traitor legions. She turned, eyes suddenly intense.
How narrow the path you walk, Death Spectre. Such storms surround you. An abyss on either side, and such a narrow path between. Be thankful you were never trained to read the future. Were you able, you might not dare another step towards it.
Karras closed on her, fists clenched at his sides. What nature of thing are you? You didn't invade my mind just to taunt me.
I am here to help prepare you, she said.
She raised a hand and brushed her hair over one ear.
And you already know what I am.
Karras's reaction was immediate and powerful. He saw the ear, how pointed it was. It was the final marker that gave her nature away.
Xenos, he growled. Damnable Elder!
He tried to rush her, but his body would no longer obey him. Young muscles strained against invisible bonds. He snarled and raged, fighting desperately to push forward. She remained icy calm as she stepped straight towards him. When they were standing eye to eye, barely half a meter apart, she placed a cool hand to the side of his head and said,
It is time to see for yourself, Space Marine. It costs me much to be here, inside your mind. Heed these warnings, or risk bringing destruction down on all you love.
At that, the forest vanished, and she with it. All was utter darkness, and Karras was falling. Arani's voice sounded in his head, this time different, mature, aged by centuries, or perhaps even millennia.
I will be watching, she said. Act with care in the times ahead. Do what is right, or I will do what I must to stop you.
The darkness receded. Red light trickled into his vision. He was still falling, but the sensation changed. He felt his adult body encasing his consciousness again, felt gravity pulling on his muscles and joints. He was heavy, grown far beyond the genetic limits of mortal men. He felt the comforting weight and warmth of power armor around thick, gene-enhanced muscles. He tried to move and found himself restrained. Lights winked before his eyes. Alert runes on a tactical display. He was in a drop pod. It was thundering through planetary atmosphere, the heat inside rising. This was an assault drop. Everything about it was familiar and clear. He could hear the roar and feel the deep shudder as the armored pod smashed through the sound barrier. Seconds later, his stomach heaved violently and the pull of gravity shifted. His organs lurched inside him. The braking jets had fired. The pod landed with a great juddering crunch. The hatches, like five titanium petals, blew their locking bolts and burst open. Karras looked out upon a mountain range of black crags covered in crisp white snow. Overhead hung a heavy graphite-colored sky. The impact clamp which had been holding him in place clicked free. He stepped out of the pod. He knew the place all too well, but no assault drop had ever happened here.
He could name all of the high peaks before him. There, the tallest and sharpest, that was Urien's Claw. He had been tested there as a neophyte, forced to navigate the pass in deep winter, hunted by rock leopards, armed only with a knife. 6 aspirants had ventured out, 4 had died.
"Why, Occludus, what game is this?"
It all seemed so real, so tangible. Even the bitter chill of the air nipped at the tip of his nose and stung his eyes. He looked down at his feet and took another step. The snow crunched under ceramite and plasteel.
Home.
He turned, knowing what he would find, and was not surprised. There, high on the mountainside behind him, was the towering western gate of Logopol, fortress monastery of the chapter. It was as glorious as ever, exquisitely carved, shining white and gold against the dark grey sky. At first, his heart soared to see it, but the joy swiftly fell away. Not a soul moved on the mighty watchtowers. No Thunderhawk gunships or Storm-Talon fighters cut across the skies. He looked around. No more drop pods either. Only his.
"This is all a lie," he muttered. "But it feels so damned real."
Whatever power the Eldar Witch had used to conjure this, it was as flawless and convincing in its detail as any psychic construct or sensorium feed he had ever experienced. Almost as convincing as reality itself. But it was not real. Angered, he turned his red eyes to the sky and shouted,
"What do you want with me, Xenos Witch? What is the point of all this?"
Nothing. Just his own words, echoing back at him from the black crags. Capricious as they were, the Eldar had contrived to bring him here for a reason. But there were no answers to be had out on the icy white slopes. That much was clear. With no other choice, Karras put one booted foot in front of the other and began his climb towards the western gate. Chapter 8. Arnaz forced himself not to hurry, but his self-control was being tested tonight. Something itched at the corners of his awareness. As he threaded his way through the alleys, he fought the impulse to look back every few seconds. Pointless, anyway. All who fought the War of Patience, what the tribes called the Kavash Garai, knew the Tau could make themselves all but invisible when they wanted to. Arnaz's tradecraft was as clean as ever. No slips, no threads for them to follow. He just had a bad feeling tonight, a feeling that he stood out somehow. He was wrong. In dark blue robes bearing the appropriate glyphs, he looked just like any other member of the city administration, a mid-ranking functionary heading home after a day of work in the name of the greater good. His cover had been built over a decade. It was solid. If his steps betrayed a little haste, a little anxiety, well, who wasn't anxious in the capital these days? Things were changing rapidly on Tychonis now. After the attempt on Cold Wave, the Tau were cracking down on every manner of criminal and known sympathizer from here to the smallest of the agri towns on the borders of the Drowned Lands. The Firecast were relentless, and the ISF were even worse, as if their loyalty to the Aun were in question on account of the attacker being human. Hardly times that encouraged a calm demeanor, especially since Arnaz and the men he was meeting were precisely who the Blueskins sought. Only Arnaz was no simple rebel. He had been placed here by a far greater power than the Speaker of the Sands. He served a mover of pieces in a much greater and deadlier game than mere planetary rebellion. For years, he had had no word from his off-world master.
His remit was to entrench himself, foster solid contacts and information streams, and wait. He had actually thought himself forgotten, left here to live out a lie that was gradually becoming his truth. He'd wondered at what point he'd stop being a sleeper agent of the Inquisition and start just being a member of Tychonite society. Where did the act stop and real life begin? Then, just months ago, word had come via psychic relay. He had been activated. The Imperium had turned its eye to this backwater world at last. He had upped his security measures. Fresh tension colored his days. He rounded the last corner and saw just up ahead the sandstone hab he was looking for. There, in the small side window, stood the green bottle with the lit candle in it, exactly as Gungeer had told him to expect. He stopped at a short wall and pretended to adjust the straps on his right boot, a last little act allowing him to check over his shoulder before he committed himself. Nothing. Nothing that could be seen. Nothing that could be sensed. He straightened, cinched his waistband a little tighter, smoothed his robe, and went around the back to a small stairway cut into the ground. This he descended, stopping by the door at the bottom. There, on a heavy portal of lacquered Cycadian oak, he tapped the prearranged sequence. There was the slightest of greeting sounds, barely audible from above. Looking up, he saw a tiny picked lens set in the sandstone doorframe. It swiveled to focus on his face and stopped. For a second, nothing happened. The lens just stared at him. Arnaz heard locking bolts being slid aside. The door opened a crack. A weathered face with the nut-brown skin so typical of the capital's human population squinted at him with eyes of pale violet.
"Evening's greetings, my cousin," said Arnaz. "Blessings on the dawn," said the other. "The day was dry. I saw a canyon hawk fly south over the market. The hawk sees much. Perhaps he saw you." "He did not see me, cousin. His eyes were on the horizon. As are the eyes of all the Ixarmakan. Ixarmakan, the far-sighted men."
The use of that name, never uttered casually, told Arnaz he had answered satisfactorily. The man behind the door moved aside, opening the portal further and allowing Arnaz to enter. Beyond was a short hallway, ending in an arch over which hung a richly embroidered curtain of deep red fabric and golden thread. The older man pulled the curtain aside and gestured him through, revealing a small, low-ceilinged room filled with men seated on cushions. A sharp mix of smells, fresh recaf, spiced bread, and body odor, hit Arnaz in the face like hot breath. He saw Gungeer sitting on the far side, facing him as he entered. When he saw Arnaz, Gungeer rose, smiling, flashing those 8 gold teeth of which he was so proud, and gestured for Arnaz to come sit in the empty space on his left. The others, all of whom Arnaz had long known from his files, but whom he had never met in person, eyed him with sullen reserve.
"Good," he thought. "They are not too quick to trust."
Arnaz bowed to them, then sat cross-legged on the empty cushion. At that point, the man who had led him inside also sat, directly opposite Arnaz, and began a round of introductions. He used first names only, each so common that were one to be called out in a crowded souk, 100 men would turn to respond. Arnaz made the appropriate, respectful responses. These men were no fools. Each was a leader in charge of several significant cells. That they had gathered here together was a sign of the times. The war of patience was a delicate thing, expected to take decades, even centuries. With the Kashtu and Ishtu utterly outnumbered and outgunned, it required the long view. Most men were incapable of giving their lives to a war that would not be won in their lifetime. These men were different. They did not care that most of them would not live to see the fruits of their labors and sacrifices. It was their faith that mattered, their belief in the right of the Imperium to hold dominion over all worlds in the known universe. The God Emperor of Man was the one true God. The teachings of Saint Sathra and his protege, Saint Isara, could not have been interpreted otherwise. The man to whom the house belonged, he who had opened the door for Arnaz, was called Dianar. He mumbled something to a man on his right, youngest of the group by the look of him, and Arnaz found himself quickly furnished with a cup of recaf and a small hard biscuit of baked rice and oryx weed. The biscuit was sweetly spiced, complimenting the hot recaf well. He had long ago learned to embrace the strong flavors so loved by these people, though the first few days after he had been smuggled onto the planet had largely been spent with one end or the other suspended over a bio-waste atomizer. Hard days. First footing on a new world was always so. He'd lost weight rapidly, but that was no bad thing for his cover here. Only the men and women of the Integrated Security Forces, what the Blueskins called the Gwea Sha, were expected to hold more muscle than ordinary citizens. The Tau had strong thoughts on such things. One's physiology was expected to fit one's role in society. Those beliefs had gradually permeated into the human cultures they embraced. Thus, soldiers were by default larger and stronger than merchants and men of other callings. With Arnaz having now sipped from the cup placed in his hands, Dianar got things underway.
"As we meet in my home," he began, "Melshala bless it, Sathra keep it safe, I will speak first."
Melshala, Urzi term for the God Emperor of Mankind, literally, Father of all men.
"Some of you know me, others do not. All present are of the blood of the true people. We are of one purpose. Let any who betray that purpose have their souls cast into the black and endless void for all eternity. As you will have heard through the network today, the Aun has ordered the ending of the current curfew from the 10th day of Salbado. An official announcement is to be made tomorrow. The city guard will continue patrolling in force and will retain the power to perform random searches. But the streets may once more be walked at any time of the day or night."
A short man with a crooked nose, he had introduced himself as Sarif, spoke up.
"It is good," he said. "High time the people were free to move about the city as they please."
"Is it?"
asked another. This one was called Rava. As Arnaz looked at him, he noted a deep and abiding sadness in the man's eyes. He had known great loss. Arnaz recalled his file. A son, his only child, gunned down by fire warriors during an arms depot raid. To maintain cover, Rava had been unable to attend his son's funeral or visit the boy's grave.
"I am not so sure, cousin. Fuller streets mean more eyes to see us as we go about our business. The traitors among our own race are a greater threat to our cause than the warp-cursed bogs. We cannot know on sight who might side with us and who might not. At least the pogs wear their sympathies in the color of their skin. These curfews have at least kept the streets clear for us."
"Laha," said Sadif, an old Kushtu word indicating conditional agreement. "But every time we break them, we risk too much for any of us to be taken alive."
Gunjir interrupted, his hand raised. As the oldest, his gesture immediately commanded silence from the others.
"What righteous liberation, cousins, ever succeeded without such risks? The dictator knows we operate here in the city and in every town and city across his stolen world. If he is ending the curfews, it is to maintain the support and favor of the Blue Tongues. Not because he believes the threat to his rule is eliminated.
Blue Tongues, slang term highly offensive, for those humans who embrace the Tao philosophy, integrate into their society, or otherwise seek favor with them.
The Commerce Guilds have been petitioning for an end to the curfews for weeks. The citizenry complain and grow restless. Certainly, Aun Ji would prefer not see our cause gain further support. The curfews have embittered so many.
Laha, laha, said Arnaz, interjecting for the first time. But we must not overlook the fact that it may be a strategy to draw us out, to make us careless.
Gunjir nodded.
Whatever the dictator's motivation for lifting the curfew now, I shall not relax my guard, and nor shall any other who values his life. The Aun knows we will have to act again to maintain and build on the support we've gained in the towns and cities in these recent weeks. He will expect us to add to our momentum. We can't let the people settle back into comfortable complacency. The Pogs know this. They will be watching for our next move.
A stout man with a white streak in his dark red beard cleared his throat and placed his right hand over his heart, indicating he wished to speak next. This was Urkis.
Coldwave has returned to the city yet again, gathering more prisoners to take south. What does the speaker say of this? Do we strike again while he is here? And what of his constant need to move inmates from the city's internment blocks? Had Ayin brothers there report no overcrowding?
Gunjir shook his head.
No word of a further attack on Coldwave has come to me, cousin. But Arnaz received word from the north more recently than I. The speaker believes the path to our rightful future is entwined with the arrival of the newcomer, this woman of the black feathers. Arnaz?
I will tell you what I know, said Arnaz.
This was why he had come. It was true that he had received encrypted comms from the speaker. Of all the men here, only he knew the rebel leader's true identity. And in turn, only the speaker knew Arnaz for what he was. No tribesman, but an agent sent from afar.
But I have never beheld the woman, he told them, save in these Picts.
He pulled several small squares of glossy paper from his robe and passed half to his left, half to his right. Each man gasped in turn as he laid eyes on them.
Your shock mirrors my own, my cousins. When I saw the two that escort her, I doubted my own eyes.
Reshva,
whispered Rava in awe. Reshva, literally, holiest of sons.
Space Marines, said Sardiv. Space Marines have come.
Chapter 9. Logopol. From its crypts and catacombs to the immense and heavily armed fortress built atop them, it was a vast and complex place. Images of death and transcendence were everywhere, engraved onto walls and doors, glorified in fine statuary, stained glass, and mosaics, dazzling in their craftsmanship yet darkly morose. 1,000 active space marines called the Crypt City home, though never had that number gathered here at once, not even on founding day. Some went out never to return, others never left. Many of these were the chapter's serfs, numbering in the tens of thousands, their entire lives dedicated to duty in the service of their warrior lords. By their blood and toil did the city endure. allowing their masters to focus on their role in the endless, galaxy-wide war. As Kara strode through the mighty gates of laser-etched titanium, he saw not a soul. No serfs, no brothers, no one. None watched him from the bastion walls or from the black balconies of the Great Keep. He would have sensed them even had he not seen them. And yet there was energy here, presence. Something was pulling at him. As he stalked through gardens filled with black and leafless trees, through training grounds, halls, and sconce-lit corridors, the feeling became a certainty. He was being pulled below, down into the great catacombs where the honored dead lay silent, their noble duty fulfilled. There at the bottom he would find the ancient dome, the Temple of Voices, and in its cold central chamber, the terrible throne of glass, so prominent in the chapter's lore, the Shariax. The moment he thought of it, he knew it was to that ancient throne he was being drawn. The certainty sped his steps. Automated Veta cages descended only part of the way. The catacombs were far older than Logopol itself. No one knew just how old, but they had been in place long millennia before the first of the first, Merin Korkaidas himself, had ever set foot on this world. From the final corridor into which the Veta doors opened, it was a long walk down a dark spiraling stair, lit only by the soft orange light of undying candles. A man might drop a stone over the edge of the stairwell and say his own name a dozen times before hearing it strike the bottom, if indeed he heard it at all. Few came this way, save to inter the dead deep in hallowed earth. A chosen few, Karras's carded foremost among them, might be called down here at the behest of the chapter master, who, once seated on the throne of glass, would never again see the light of the Occludian day. From the bottom of the stairs it took Karras another half hour to reach his destination. And the stride of a space marine is far longer and faster than that of an ordinary man. He passed through the halls of honor, past the calcified and enthroned bodies of every chapter master the Death Spectres had ever known. Though all this was illusion, some trick of the Eldar Witch, Karras still could not allow himself to pass by those who had sacrificed themselves on the throne of glass without saluting each, fist to chest, and offering up a whispered prayer of gratitude and profound respect. All had been slowly petrified as the Shariax leached their life force away. Why each had knowingly embraced such a fate was knowledge beyond Karras's rank. But the need must have been great indeed. He tried not to think about the fact that Athio Cordatus would, most likely, be the next Death Spectre to embrace that dark fate. It was the way of the chapter that each chief of the Librarius be made chapter master when time demanded. The Shariax accepted only the most powerful psychers. It was even conceivable, though humility made him scorn the notion, that Karras himself might one day be forced to sit upon it. No, he thought. Most Death Watch never even make it home. Likely my fate lies elsewhere. After briefly praying at the feet of the petrified Korkaidas, last and largest of the enthroned masters, Karras entered the great cavern in which the Temple of Voices awaited, silent and brooding and monolithic, its pillars rising to points near the cavern roof, its great dome rimed with dirt and age, but eternally strong. He crossed the broad stone bridge that led to the entrance. Beneath him, far down in the dark, the icy waters of an underground river murmured like an army of ghosts, watching him, muttering about his trespass here. This was not a place Karras would ever have ventured without being called directly by the psychic impulse of the Megir. Freed by the knowledge that all this was a lie ripped from his memory, he strode forward with purpose, eager to have it done with. At the arched stone doors he stopped, wrestling the urge to show reverence, then placed a gauntleted hand on each and pushed. It took a great deal of strength. The doors were heavy, but he was powerful and they swung aside, grinding as they scraped across the stone floor. Dust and a light shower of debris fell from the ceiling, as if no one had been here for many, many years. He tried to ignore the forebodings that arose in him, but they grew more insistent as he neared his goal. Passing through two more sets of smaller, lighter doors, he found himself inside the final antechamber, beyond which lay the main chamber. He crossed to the final set of doors and breathed deep. The air was cold and dry and smelled of dust. That was wrong. It should have smelled of incense. He realized his primary heart was pounding. "Do not trust what you find beyond these doors," he told himself. "The alien attempts to manipulate you. Nothing more. She serves only the needs of her insidious people. Do not be deluded. Not by any of it." With that, he placed a hand on each of the stone inner doors, took a deep breath, and pushed his way into the sacred chamber. This was a place that shunned light, where the chapter's greatest and most noble came to make a long, slow, fatal act of self-sacrifice. It was a sacrifice made mostly in the dark. Those whose gifts allowed them to be in far-off places and see far-off things needed no light. Powerful psychers often went physically blind over time, their optic nerves no longer necessary given the greater potency of their witch sight. The Shariax itself gave off a ghostly bluish glow that pulsed like a heartbeat. Very faint, but illumination enough that Karras's enhanced eyes allowed him to see his surroundings by it. He moved towards the throne apprehensively and noted the large figure seated there. The silhouette was unmistakable. There, the curve of each broad pauldron. There, the sculpted helm decorated with honors in the form of laurels, crafted from silver and gold, and inlaid with precious gems. So here, in Aranyi's version of Logopor, Athiocordatus was chapter master. "But this is no future that will come to ever pass," thought Karras. "If she thinks Logopor will ever stand abandoned..." There was another thing she had got wrong. None who took the throne did so in armor and helm. On ascending to the position of first spectre, the new chapter master presented his armor and weapons to the one who would follow his sacrifice next. And that was always the chief librarian. So why was this figure before Karras, dressed in full Adeptus Astartes plate? It made no sense. "If she pulled all this from my mind, she knew this already, and her choices are deliberate. What does she mean by this?" Yet another inconsistency came to him now, for though the throne was clearly occupied, the one atop it radiated no psychic presence. His soul should have been so bright, so potent, that it could be felt from orbit. But even so close to the locus of that power, there was nothing, not even a trace of an immortal soul. Karras girded himself and strode forward determinedly. He flexed his will, causing faint wisps of psychic light to coruscate around him. The added illumination showed him the seated figure in much greater detail. The armor was indeed that of the chief librarian, but it looked ancient, caked in dust. There was nothing of Cordatus's life force and spirit in that chamber. As Karras came to a stop at the bottom of the dais, the figure moved. It lowered its head to look at him. Dust fell from the helm. Its visor lenses flared red. They locked themselves to Karras's eyes. Wordlessly, the armored figure shifted again, tossing something heavy. Karras caught it. When he looked down at the object in his hands, what he saw made him cry out in denial. He dropped it and staggered back a step. The severed head of his mentor hit the floor and rolled. When Karras found his voice, it was not to the seated figure on the Shariax that he roared. It was to the air around him, to all of this, to the one who had created it and placed him here. "Eldar, witch!" he raged. "Blood, cursed Xenos! Show yourself, so I can cut you down!" The figure on the Shariax laughed at him, a harsh sound that boomed and rasped from the helm's vocalizer grills. With gauntleted hands, the figure reached up and undid the seals below the jawline of the helm. Then, slowly, deliberately, it raised the helm from its head. Karas glared at it, and the white balefire of his psychic power flared. But what he saw made him reel backwards once again. There upon the Shariax, grinning down at him, he saw himself. The features were precise, down to each individual scar, and yet it was Karas, as he had never been. His mouth twisted with malign glee, a bloodthirsty madness in his eyes. "What is the meaning of this?" Karas demanded, rage rushing back over him to replace shock. "Answer me, damn you!" The false Karas laughed again and rose to full height. Karas dropped into a combat stance on reflex. He felt his power responding to the threat, welling up within him as it always did when he was threatened. He began to coalesce that ethereal strength inside him. He would obliterate this thing, this insult. He would rip this whole damned nightmare apart. Even as he thought this, the false Karas flexed its armor-plated muscles and stretched all four of its arms. Karas hadn't seen the extra appendages until they unfolded. Long, bony, covered in glistening chitin, and ending in three blade-like talons. He had seen such arms before, all too many of them and all too close. Gene Stealer! Behind the monstrosity that dared to wear his face, he saw the pulsing of the Shariax quicken. It began to glow brighter, as if sensing the surge of violence that was about to erupt. Karas felt the light from it burning his soul, scorching him. He kept his range, stepping back as the four-armed abomination began to descend the steps of the dais towards him. At the bottom it stopped, its shoulders squared, all four arms splayed wide for slashing attacks. Karas saw now that it was taller than he. Its skin had a waxy quality, and as it grinned again he could see that the teeth were pointed and sharp, like tiny white daggers. When it spoke, its voice had become that of the Eldar witch, incongruously musical and feminine. "You think I toy with you, Death Spectre? I would waste neither the time nor the power. I do this out of need. The paths before you are many. To your kin, you are the Kaddash, or let us say that you may be. They place too much hope in you, and it may undo them. Others still have seen flashes of you in futures they are working to create. They will use you to bring about their ambitions." The false Karas, the tainted Karas, gestured down at its own body, then turned its gaze pointedly to the left and right at those terrible outstretched arms. "To yet others, you represent the gravest of threats, the undoing of all they have achieved. You can scarcely imagine. Time and fate boil and churn around you. It is a maelstrom of possibility, unreadable. So many paths branch off into horror and suffering. So few lead to the light. Will you be a savior, a destroyer, or something greater or worse than either?" Karas felt sick with revulsion. Words, just words. He did not believe any of this.
"Damn her arrogance. I'll have her life. I am a soldier," he snarled. "No more, no less. My fate is to fight and die."
The abomination laughed, not with Arani's voice, but with one low and bestial. It gestured with all four arms to Karas's right and left. He sensed movement all around him. Armored feet sounded on stone. He turned, right hand raised and ready, condensed psychic fire flaring from a ball of power that was growing in his palm. He would burn all around him to ashes. Before he could launch it, however, the sight of those that surrounded him froze both his hearts. In their hundreds, on either side, were his brother death specters. They crowded around him, hissing like beasts from beneath cracked and rusted battle helms. Each bore the same terrible twin pairs of limbs as the false Karras, mark of the Tyranid gene seed. Karras heard Aranyi's voice again, though it issued from the air this time and not from the abomination's mouth.
Be wise in your choices, Lyandro Karras. Look beneath the surface. The chain of events has already begun. Tychonis will decide much.
As the last of those words echoed in the domed ceiling, the twisted false death specters began pressing in towards him, reaching out with their lethal claws. Karras gritted his teeth and opened his inner gates to more of the power he commanded.
Xenos tricks and lies, he growled.
Then, much louder,
I deny you!
Empyrean power reached a crescendo, coursing through him, barely restrainable now. He readied himself to unleash it with a battle roar. Just before he loosed it, he felt cold hands press firmly against each side of his head, and with that touch, all his power left him, bled away in an instant. All went dark, all went silent. No dome, no Shariax, no unholy abominations. For several seconds, he was just that mote of awareness again, a soul lost in a formless void. Then light and sound exploded all around him. Gravity yanked on him. He staggered, steadied himself, opened his eyes, and saw muddy ground. Blood-red clouds tumbled through a purple sky. Rockets and artillery shells screamed overhead. So close, so low, deafening. He saw the fighter jets and marauder bombers of the Imperial Navy tearing through the air. All around him the ground was carpeted deep with the dead. Men, women, children, all torn to pieces, their blood turning the earth into a crimson mire. To his right, he heard the sharp report of gunfire, followed by desperate cries. He saw figures clash in great tides, shining chitins striking polished armor plate. Las beams scored lines across his vision. Meters away, an artillery shell bit into the ground and exploded, throwing him from his feet straight onto his back. Dirt geezered up into the air and rained down on him, drumming on his armor like hailstones. He looked up at the clouds and saw something vast and dark breaking through them. At first, he took it for a ship, long and sleek of prow. But as more of the object eased itself from the cloud cover, he saw that it was organic, a creature almost city-sized, with great tendrils stretching from its vast torso. There were apertures all along its body. From these, swarms of flying monstrosities emerged. They turned their heads towards the conflict on the ground and dived. Karras rolled and pushed himself up.
None of this is real, he bellowed at the sky. Do you hear me, Eldar? None of this is real. It means nothing.
There was no answer. Karras roared in frustration. He looked down at his hands, at his legs, full battle plate, with all the weight and reassuring power it conferred. It felt real. He heard the blood rushing in his ears, felt his primary heart beating. Runes, projected on his retinas by his helmet systems, told him his heartbeat was elevated. Adrenaline, too. He flexed his fists. What was happening to him? What was this? Had he been broken on Kiaro after all? Was he now trapped in his own insane mind? Or was this some trick of the demon? Did the Eldar witch exist at all? He could smell the stink of blood and burning bodies. He could feel the wind through his armor's advanced sense feeds, the pressure of the air, the tug of the gore-sodden ground on his boots.
What if this is real? He asked himself. What if I suffered some kind of psychic seizure or collapse? What
if I'm really here?
He could be sure of nothing. No, not quite nothing. He was certain his recall of that day in the burning forest was just a memory. He was sure the trek through abandoned Logopol and the twisted horrors in the chamber were false.
Those things did not happen. They did not.
But this? He looked again at his armored fists, one silver, one black.
I am Deathwatch.
Battle raged around him. Another shell landed close, shaking the ground, throwing up gouts of fire and great clods of earth. He felt so present, so grounded. He checked his maglocks and webbing for weapons. None. No bolter, no pistol, no grenades, nothing. He slid one hand back to see if his knife was sheathed at his lower back where he usually wore it. It was not. Archimand II was gone. The precious force sword his mentor had entrusted to him should have been slung between his shoulder and his armor's power pack. It was not. He was unarmed in the middle of a war zone, alone in a muddy clearing among rocks and bodies and shell-blasted trees, mayhem and death on all sides, great tyrannid organisms breaching the skies, imperial forces fighting desperately to push them back. He searched for a landmark, for something that would tell him where he was, anything at all that might give him an idea. His search was cut short. Figures loomed up out of the mire, surrounding him, hissing and chittering, their eyes hard and cold like black stones. He'd faced such things, seen good brothers die, swarmed by them and hacked apart. They advanced on him as one, long scythe-like talons raised for a lethal downward stroke.
Termagants!
He longed for Archimand. Four tyrannid warrior forms were more than a match for most space marines at close quarters, but with force sword in hand, his eldritch power coursing through it, the odds would have been altered dramatically. As they closed, the beasts breathed loudly. Drool dripped from their razor-lined jaws. Here was prey. But if the creatures thought Karras unarmed in the absence of any visible means of defense, they were very much mistaken. Real or not, Karras wasn't about to take any chances. He brought forth his power, joining it to his violent intent. He spread his arms, hands open, and dropped into a combat stance. Flickering arcs of blue-white power writhed up and down his vambraces like electrical serpents. He felt the pressure building in his mind, a great welling of force. He wrestled it under control, shaped it to suit his needs. In his mind's eye, he marked his targets, marked the path he wanted the deadly energy to take. The termagants closed on him. They tensed their haunches, ready to leap, ready to carve him apart. The moment they sprang, Karras unleashed blinding spears of psychic lightning upon them. There was a great cracking sound, like the splintering of bones. His vision went black. He felt himself falling forward, his skin suddenly wet and icy cold. He struck solid ground, knees and forehead smacking hard on smooth marble. He pushed himself up on his palms just in time to vomit. Thick mouthfuls of a strange, sweet-smelling gel gushed out. He tried to open his eyes, but they were gummed shut. His body hurt. It ached all over. He felt pathetically weak. He convulsed again, bringing up more of the strange, sticky substance. There was a bitterness to it, despite the sweet smell. Not something he recognized. Raising his right hand from the floor, he wiped forcefully at his eyes. A rough voice sounded from a few meters in front of him.
No, brother, step back. Let him gather himself. Give him time, but keep your guard up.
He knew that voice. Only space marines spoke Gothic so low it shook the air like that.
Manus Locaine.
It was the voice of the Storm Warden, the first librarian of the Watch at Dameroth. Karras forced his eyelids open at last. He found himself looking at a floor of black marble flagstones coated in thick, transparent slime. His vision was flawless, as sharp as it had ever been.
I know I lost an eye killing the Broodlord. How is it I can see,
perfectly.
He looked down at his hands, braced on the black marble. He saw his fingers splayed there.
Something else is wrong, he thought. Something is different.
He brought his right forearm in front of his face and turned it this way and that. A chill ran down his spine. Where was the scar he had earned on Calvariash? Where were the burn marks that had dappled his flesh, the acid burns he had suffered at the siege of New Golladin? And where were his wards, the pentagrammic and hexagrammic tattoos he had worn since his acceptance as a full battle brother? Where were his protections? What had happened to him? Confusion etched itself in deep lines on his face. He pushed himself from the floor and shakily stood up. To find himself facing 5 space marines in full armor, 3 of which were pointing bolters straight at him. A 4th was pointing the nozzle of a flamer in his direction too. The last figure, and the only one without a visible weapon, was Locaine. Karras met the Storm Warden's gaze, and was surprised to find the eyes so cold and hard, devoid of the rapport the two had built up during Karras's time in Death Watch training. No smile of greeting graced those stern, craggy features.
"Is this real, Locaine?" Karras croaked.
His voice was rough. Speaking hurt his throat.
"Throne and terror," he rasped. "Tell me, this is real."
Locaine stared at him a moment, then spoke. The words stunned Karras, chilling him to the bone.
"Who are you?"
the Storm Warden demanded.
"Who are you? And whom do you serve? Speak now, or die."
Chapter 10
"Throne and terror!"
exclaimed Rava. There was no mistaking the figures in the Pict, figures of legend, icons of imperial glory. They were the will of the God Emperor made flesh. For a moment the men gathered in the basement sat in mutual silence, stunned, unable to process the implications of what they were seeing. Urkis spoke first.
"I do not understand this, cousins. These Reshfa..."